Theophilogue presents a book reading, Tradition and Incarnation, by William Portier. I'm Bradley Cochran, the author. The following is a book excerpt from William Portier's book, Tradition and Incarnation. The excerpt comes from Chapter 1, entitled The Great Questions. The Great Questions. The Religious Dimension. Our world is full of religions. Most cultures exhibit what we can intelligently recognize as religious behavior. Putting aside until Chapter 3 the task of defining the term religion, we can note that wherever we find human beings, we usually find a god or gods, religious behavior, and religious faith. Critics of religion, both ancient and modern, have dismissed it as a mere human creation, a fire around which people who can't bear to imagine a cold and indifferent universe huddle. Religious people believe that the gods are quite real and have manifested themselves. Critics cannot deny that religions of the world, along with their share of charlatans and hypocrites, have also inspired many selfless and truly holy people whom we can't help but admire. In spite of reoccurring prophecies that humanity will soon outgrow them, religious faith and practice remain. Whether we agree with the religious people or their critics, or simply don't know, the near universal appeal, the persistence, and the transforming power of religions are intriguing. What is there about human beings that opens them to religions and their claims about things unseen? Where do religious experience and religious language fit into human experience in general? This chapter will address these questions by trying to lay open what we might call the depth dimension of human experience. That innermost part of us, best represented by some combination of traditional symbols of heart and head. It is at this level that we can best hear the words of the philosophers, poets, and gods. We will begin by distinguishing between ordinary and extraordinary human experience. Ordinary human experience. What is meant here by ordinary human experience takes place at the level of what is often called common sense. It is routine. We don't have to think about it. Getting out of bed, taking a shower, brushing your teeth, putting on your shoes, starting your car, driving to school or work, are all the kinds of stuff of which the ordinary is made. For our purposes, its distinguishing feature is that we don't have to think about it. The ordinary day-to-day routine doesn't usually give rise to reflection. We tend to take it for granted. But to describe ordinary experience as routine is far from dismissing it. Without the basic structure it provides, we might all go mad. What would happen, for example, if you had to figure out the inner workings of an internal combustion engine every time you wanted to start your car? The routine is comfortable. It lets us know what to expect. Each culture puts at human disposal a set of ready-to-hand things from which we put together our pre-reflective routine. What is common sense for one culture, e.g. cars and planes and how to use them, may be quite extraordinary for another. What you regard as routine or ordinary will be related to your culture. Extraordinary human experience. At certain points in every life, the routine of ordinary experience is broken or interrupted in a dramatic way. By contrast with the routine, we can call these disruptions extraordinary. The terms ordinary and extraordinary are correlative or defined in relation to one another. To have one, you need the other. We recognize and name the extraordinary by its contrast with what we know as ordinary. This gives us the relative routine or ordinary and the relatively extraordinary or special. One of the distinguishing features of extraordinary experiences is that they can lead people to think more deeply or at a different level than they usually do when they are performing day-to-day tasks. Extraordinary experiences are quite common in the sense that they happen to everyone at different times. They are only extraordinary in relation to the routine of the person who has them. Four examples will be used to clarify extraordinary experience and its effects: birth, death, love, and evil. Birth and death establish the boundaries of a given routine. Love and evil shape its highs and its lows. Four examples. Number one, birth. Although some psychologists speak of the trauma of birth and its effects on us, our own births are not an issue here. I'm referring rather to the births that occur in one's own family or in other families that are close to us. Although millions of people are born each day, and in that sense, birth is quite common, it usually only happens in the lives of individual sets of parents, for example, a relatively few times in their lives. In that sense, birth is statistically and personally extraordinary. Some women have described childbirth as an experience of often but not always unspeakable physical pain to be followed by exhilarating joy. Babies represent for us a renewal and reaffirmation of life. They remind us of new beginnings and human possibilities. While we have all seen diagrams of the hit or miss process that unites sperm and egg and know quite well how the baby comes into being, we still speak innocently of the quote, miracle of birth. To hold a newborn baby that is our own flesh and blood, and to realize that this little human being didn't exist before, and now it does, and that you and everybody else got here this way, is to know this wonder. The wonder will not last as birth gives way to the demanding routine of infant care and child rearing. But it returns with our occasional reflective binges about what the future might hold for this new being, and about the possibility of prodigious consequences of how we treat it. These are not the thoughts of which routines are made, and were we to sustain them indefinitely, they would probably drive us crazy. For a pregnant woman who is alone and abandoned, for parents who, for whatever reasons, do not want the routine to be intruded upon by new life and all its attendant complications, the wonder turns to dread. The two responses are closely related. In both cases, the awesome magnitude of new being invades our lives. It can be greeted as a gracious gift or resisted as an intolerable imposition. Often, we greet new life with complex combinations of the two responses. Example 2. Death. As with birth, we are not concerned here with our own deaths, but with those of people close to us, parents, children, relatives, and friends. Death puts a final end to the routine and to life as we know it. In the process, it raises the deepest and most disturbing questions about the possible meaning or absurdity of human life. Is this it? Why are we even born if it is only to come to this? Do we just return to the chemical elements out of which we are composed? Anyone who has held a dead child, watched a loved one die slowly and painfully, touched the cold, dead face of one's mother or father's corpse, knows the awful pull of these questions. The end of the routine makes us wonder why there's any routine at all. It throws into question the very nature of what we're dealing with in human life. Death enables us to see life whole, and so we use the term life as in, life is sad, life is a bust, or life, I love you, all is groovy. What about this life we talk about? Is life such that it has it in for us, as it seems when the lives of our fellows are taken away and we are left to face our own mortality? Is life gracious, as it seems when it bestows the gift and promise of new life? Or is life simply cold and indifferent? Do we even have any justification for speaking this way? Such questions become even more poignant when death involves the innocent, a young child, or an obviously good person who has suffered more than we would wish on even the worst of us. Can we expect anything better out of life? Why do we even want to, or think we have a right to? The old retort that no one ever said life had to be fair cannot take away the sadness or the anger or the longing. We seem to want more than this life has to offer. Is this a clue that points to the nature of reality, or simply a warning that we need more realistic expectations? Although death raises in dramatic form the question about the ultimate meaning of our lives, we can and do find short of ultimate meanings. If someone were to ask you, for example, why are you here? You could answer at various levels with reference to livelihood, career goals, and personal preferences. These are all short of ultimate meanings. The ultimate meaning is what is true in the last analysis. The last meaning, the meaning of all the little meanings, the last why that would answer at the most radical level the question about the reason you are here. Perhaps there is no such answer, no ultimate meaning. Death brings us to the point of facing up to this possibility. Life gives us death, but it doesn't tell us what death means. This leaves us in an ambiguous situation. Life might not mean anything in particular beyond the finite meanings we give it in terms of our various cultures. The question about ultimate meaning might just be a silly one. Example 3. Love. Love and evil are used here to stand for what happens in us when we experience the human capacity for selfless behavior and the human capacity for cruelty and inhumanity. In the case of love, we're speaking of the effects that unselfish behavior, done for the sake of someone else, might have on the person who receives it. Romantic love is certainly not excluded from such an understanding of love. But love as selfless behavior is much broader than romantic love, and some forms of romantic love can be quite selfish. Although I am committed to the proposition that unselfish behavior is preferable to cruelty, the point here is not primarily an ethical one. It is rather to explore the kinds of questions that our experience of love and evil raise about the human condition. This is pre-ethical. Experiencing love in the sense meant here often rings one up short. It comes to us as a gift, unowed and often unexpected. While we might try to manipulate the feelings and behaviors of others more often than we'd like to admit, we cannot coerce or control love freely given. The record of human history, as well as the experience of most people, testifies to the ordinary human capacity for heroic self-sacrifice. Among the examples we could include are courageous soldiers who give their lives for their comrades, daring rescuers who risk their own lives to save others, women and men who devote their lives to care for the poor, the sick, the elderly, and the dying, and mothers and fathers who carry out the daily nurture of their children. Often we have a hard time believing that others could really love us unselfishly, just for us. We tend to wonder at their gifts, suspecting that we don't deserve them, or fearing that they'll be taken away. We tend to be in awe of genuine human goodness when we encounter it in such phenomenon as faithfulness to promises that we might have broken. Another's love is a potential judgment on our own frequently selfish behavior. Often it makes us feel unworthy, challenging our own patterns of behavior, making us wonder if what we consider good in others is really the way we ought to behave. Again, the emphasis here is not on ethics, especially if that is understood in the most primitive form, as the imposition of external standards. The emphasis is rather on the deep pre-ethical questions about the human condition raised by the experience of love. Example 4. Evil. This section is not about what modern theologians and philosophers sometimes call the problem of evil, or theodicy. Nor is evil being used in a primarily ethical category. Rather, the emphasis is on the deep questions about the human condition raised by our own experiences of cruelty, inhumanity, and seemingly undeserved suffering. We can experience this kind of evil ourselves or witness as others suffer it. In discussing the problem of evil, theologians and philosophers sometimes distinguish between the kind of evil that others do to us, like cruelty or inhumanity, and that which befalls or overtakes us by accident, such as cancer or other diseases. Because diseases such as cancer are often caused by the refusal of human agents to take public health into account when they make their business decisions, this distinction cannot be too rigidly applied. But it works in a general enough way that we can limit our present concerns to the kind of evil that is done to us by others. Evil is being used in a common sense way that precedes ethical reflection. This use presumes our natural revulsion at the cruelty and inhumanity human beings inflict on one another. The cruel taunts with which children torment one another provide a frightening indication that the human capacity for inhumanity runs as deep as our capacity for heroism. Who among us has not been the clumsy one, the fat one, the handicapped one, the one who is too smart, the one whose clothes were wrong or whose parents were strange? Who among us doesn't know someone who is just downright mean? Who has been spared the sting of human cruelty? On a grander and more ghastly scale, we have the ovens of Dachau, the colored water fountains, lunch counters, and schools, and their nagging but subtle residues in American society. What would you have felt if you were a Jew being experimented upon or incarcerated simply for being a Jew? A black man being lynched in the segregated South simply for being black? These are the taunts of children raised to the most gruesome powers. Anger, rage, determination, resignation, or despair cannot take away the radical sense that such things should not be allowed to happen to us. Religious people ask where their God has gone. We feel we have the right not only to complain, but to lament and protest such treatment to whatever powers there are. At some deep level, such behavior strikes at our very sense of humanity. Like life itself, the human beings to emerge against the background of the recognizably inhuman. What is human anyway? What are human beings that they seem to have such divided capacities? The most disturbing moment in our reflections and our responses to human cruelty comes when we begin to realize that we are brothers and sisters to the grand inquisitors and the Hitlers of our world. Our hearts can twist themselves into the kinds of knots that lead to the point where we can write off whole groups of people as less than what we are. We have all invoked our own particular versions of the final solution. We are weak composites of conflicting motives and impulses. We fail to live up to the very ideals we have set for ourselves. We break faith with the ones we love. This is not to deny that sometimes we can be heroically faithful. Sometimes we do come through. It is precisely this ambiguity that raises the deepest questions about us. What kind of beings are we? How ought we to act? Should our behavior lead to profound regret at our weakness or only to cynicism about all forms of oughts, whether they come from within or without us. Summary characteristics of extraordinary experiences. The four examples used here to illustrate extraordinary experiences are by no means exhaustive. In his book, Faith and Doctrine, Gregory Baum, a Canadian theologian, adds more descriptions of what he calls depth experiences, both secular and religious. Among his examples of secular depth experiences, he includes friendship, conscience, truth, human solidarity, and compassionate protest. These and many other examples could be developed along the lines indicated here to formulate the kinds of questions about the human condition that open up its depth dimension. We can summarize the preceding experiences in the following way. First, extraordinary experiences are strikingly different from the routine or the ordinary against which they appear. They tend to break the patterns of our experience in dramatic ways. To locate them in the geography of experience, we often use spatial metaphors. Thus, we speak of the depths of human experience, or its borders, or limits, or peaks. Second, in themselves, extraordinary experiences are ambiguous. Death, for example, does not also tell us what death should mean, or how we should interpret it, or answer the questions that it raises. Death is therefore ambiguous, admitting of more than one possible interpretation. Third, we tend to remember extraordinary experiences, and they can exert powerful influences on the direction of our lives. The stronger and more striking they are, the more power they have to affect us. Fourth, because of their unusual character, extraordinary experiences often lead us to think seriously about the meaning and direction of our lives. This kind of thinking or reflection takes place at a different level. Usually we call it deeper than the kind of thinking we do in the everyday world of common sense. Extraordinary experiences often give rise to questions that are very difficult to answer with our usual problem-solving methods. You've been listening to the Theophilogue podcast, Theology, Philosophy, Dialogue. For more audio podcasts from Theophilogue, please visit theophilogue.wordpress.com. That's theophilogue.wordpress.com.